You've tuned in to the most crazy rocking metal podcast on the air. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Metal from the Inside.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Metal from the Inside podcast. I'm your host, Sydney Taylor. Thank you guys so much for tuning into another episode and joining me for another week. You guys are listening to episode 36 of the Metal from the Inside podcast. This week, I am bringing you guys a brand new interview with bass player Phil Suzan, who is currently the bassist in the band Last in Line, the band that, of course, features members of the original Dio band, such as Vivian Campbell and Vinnie Appice. Jimmy Bain was, of course, part of the project as well up until his passing in early 2016, and after his passing, they asked Phil to come in and take Jimmy's place in Last in Line, and since then, since 2016, Phil has been a part of the group. They've written and recorded one studio record together and are currently working on the third, which we get into in the interview. And most of you know Phil from his time in the Ozzy Osbourne band. He wrote one of the most massive singles in Ozzy's solo career, Shot in the Dark, and of course was the bass player on the 1986 album The Ultimate Sin, which just celebrated its 35th anniversary a couple weeks back. Personally, Shot in the Dark is my favorite Ozzy Osbourne solo song. I tell a little bit of a story in our conversation about how special that song is to me, and it was so cool to be able to sit down and speak with Phil about that song, as he was a co-writer and had a big part in bringing that song to the table for the Ultimate Sin record. We also have the opportunity to chat a little bit about what Phil has been up to during the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, we've all been home, which has given Phil the opportunity to work on some of his own solo music. Phil has done some solo records in the past, so this is not his first solo effort, but he decided to take this time to write and record some brand new singles, and he actually released two of them so far. The first was released back in November, titled Please Don't Make Me Wait, and the second one was just released back on Valentine's Day of this year, and it was titled Fly Again. So they're really, really great. You can go ahead and watch the videos and listen to the tracks on Phil's official YouTube channel, which we will link on our social media, so you can go ahead and check that out. But we get into how those songs came to be, the process of Phil's songwriting, and that he also has some more singles in the works that are coming very, very soon. Aside from diving into what Phil has been working on musically, we also get into some really, really interesting topics. The first being about the disconnect that we often see in America regarding rock music and the popularity of some of our favorite bands, and how that has related to Phil's career with certain projects that he's been a part of, and how we often see rock music and heavy metal being revered in different countries, such as, you know, countries in South America and Europe and all of these different places outside of the US, which I actually wrote my senior thesis on, you know, part of that topic. That was a topic that I did a lot of research on, which I let Phil into, and we dive a little bit into that topic. We also talk about the resurgence of vinyl and how a lot of us music fans who have been kind of programmed to get into this streaming and digital download world often really miss the art of a physical record and everything that came with that experience, from the artwork to the liner notes to being able to get up and flip a record and all of that fun stuff. So it was really fun to get into some of those topics with Phil, aside from just all of the work that he does, you know, to kind of speak a little bit about some of these major themes that Phil also still feels as a music fan himself. And it was just a total blast to have Phil on the podcast. As I mentioned, his work, and especially his work with Ozzy Osbourne, is so incredibly important to me, and it was such an honor for me to be able to speak with Phil on this week's episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast, and I think that you guys are really going to enjoy our conversation. I also would like to say a huge thank you to everyone who has taken the time to subscribe to the Metal from the Inside YouTube channel. This week, we hit 1,000 subscribers, which is so massive, and just to put it in perspective, back when I shared my Jolyn Turner interview with you guys, at the end of January, we had 36 subscribers on the YouTube channel. It is now March 18th, and we are at over 1,000, which is so incredible. I am so thankful that you guys want to watch these conversations and to keep up with the podcast, with the interviews that I'm doing. It's really just so incredible. I can't think of any other way to say it, but that I'm just so thankful that you guys are here and you are a part of the Metal from the Inside family. So thank you guys so, so much. If you are listening and you are a Metal from the Inside YouTube subscriber, it is just wonderful. I'm so, so thankful. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I am also here to remind you guys that we now have Metal from the Inside merchandise, which is available at www.season-of-mist.com. I partnered up with renowned hard rock and heavy metal label Season of Mist to bring you guys official Metal from the Inside merchandise. So you guys can go ahead to that URL and purchase some merchandise that is made just for you. Whether you would like a t-shirt, a hoodie, a muscle tank, for my ladies out there is a woman fit tee available. There's also a tee with a cutout back. There's a cropped hoodie, a regular racer back tank top. So many different options. So whatever your heart desires is available for you to purchase when it comes to the Metal from the Inside merchandise. And you guys can actually see me wearing a piece of the merch if you'd like to get an idea of what it looks like on my interview this week with Phil that is again posted to our YouTube channel, Metal from the Inside. So if you'd like to actually see what a piece of the merch looks like, go ahead and check out the visual component to my interview with Phil, and you will be able to see for yourself. So again, you can go to www.season-of-mist.com to purchase your Metal from the Inside merchandise. And if you do end up buying a piece of merch, be sure to tag me in you wearing it, or when you receive it, I would love to share on all of our social media pages and my social media page as well, you guys repping the merchandise. It's just so cool to see when that happens and to see you guys wearing the logo and representing Metal from the Inside. So be sure to tag me and let me know. All right, that's enough of me blabbing on and on for this week's episode. When we get back from this very short break, we are going to get right into my interview with bass player Phil Suzon. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast. This week, I am joined by none other than Phil Suzon, who is currently the bassist for the band Last in Line, which many of you know features some of the original members of the Dio lineup. But aside from his work in Last in Line, Phil has done some incredible stuff throughout his career and has worked with some incredible artists such as Ozzy Osbourne, Billy Idol, Johnny Halliday, Kings of the Sun, so much more. He's done so much over the course of his career. And I've really been wanting to get Phil on the podcast because I really loved his work over the years, as I just mentioned. And especially his work with Ozzy Osbourne has meant a great deal to me, The Ultimate Sin and everything like that. And one specific song in particular, which I will touch on hopefully in a little bit to appease the major music fanatic in me. But I've really been looking forward to this. So thank you so much, Phil, for taking the time to join me.
You're welcome. It's great to be here, Sydney. Thank you very much. You picked on a couple of very interesting credits that I have. And you know, that Kings of the Sun album is a great record. And I really loved working with those guys. They wanted me to join their band, but then they were moving to Australia. And I just didn't think that was going to be possible. But it remains one of my favorite projects that I did. So it's nice that you mentioned that one.
Yeah. I feel like it often goes a little bit under the radar because, I mean, I believe it came out right in the early 90s, but I feel like it was such a great project. I wish more people, you know, were aware of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great band. I mean, they had that one big hit, I think, just prior to that, Drop the Gun, it was a single.
Right.
And it's like a cross between, Jeff's a little bit like a cross between a Billy Idol and an Angus Young or and a Bon Scott or something, I don't know, but it was very AC/DC and it was very kind of punk, and it was a really great record. Anyway,
yeah, absolutely. So kind of just getting started, as a lot of my listeners do know, you know, in the beginning, I kind of just always like to start out with just, you know, how you've been, because, you know, in the current climate that we're in, it's been a weird year. And I know that you've, of course, been a touring musician for, you know, decades now. So aside from the fact that it, you know, just must feel weird for you to be home for so long, you know, have all this free time, you know, I know that you have been up to some cool things. You know, you've been working on some solo music, which I want to talk about a little bit. Of course, working with Last in Line, you've been doing these cool you know, live streams every so often, you know, with the rest of the guys, as I know you guys are working on this next record. So a lot you've been doing over the course of the past year. So tell us a little bit about how you've been and what this, you know, past year has looked like for you.
Well, you know, I think I've been better than most. I've got to say, and I consider myself very fortunate or blessed, and or both, that you know, there have been other things going on. I decided to move to Vegas, and did that right when the pandemic was beginning. So a lot of this last year has been spent in relocating and resetting up. So I really felt like I've been doing something. It's not like I've been sat down in one place just staring at the walls. And I know a lot of people have, and that's really tough on them. Part of the reason I think why, you know, we try to keep our fans engaged, let's try to let them know that, you know, I mean, how important they are to us. You know, if it wasn't for our fans, we wouldn't have a career. So we're all part of the same team. That's the way I see it. And so it's important for us to stay connected with fans. It's a very different, a different situation to how it used to be back in the day before social media, and in the 80s and in the 90s, where, you know, you could write a letter to your favorite artist and you could put money that you'd never get a response. And now if you don't get a response, then it's very unusual. Right. So we have a much closer bond with people. And so with that in mind, you know, we try to keep people engaged. But I do that, and then I just keep myself busy. I'm like a jack of all trades, so I like to do lots of things. I've got more hobbies than most people. And so whether it's cooking, or whether it's fixing bikes, or fixing stuff around the house, or, you know, recording songs, or, you know, whatever it is, I'm always trying to do something. So, yeah, keeping busy.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned cooking, and I was going to say, you know, you've been showing off your cooking skills online on your Instagram page. You do your COVID kitchen series, the 59-second gourmet thing, which was so fun that you started that, because it kind of shows a different little side of you. And yeah, what prompted you, I guess, of course, the pandemic, but what kind of prompted you to start doing that? Because you put some cool stuff up, honestly.
I was just thinking, what can I do? And, you know, I mean, I always had this idea that I wanted to do a rock and roll cookery show, and I actually almost executed it a couple of times, but it's just not been right just yet. But doing it like this, I just thought it was a funny thing. I remember thinking, you know, it'd be cool to put something out on a video. And then I realized at that time, you could only have like up to a minute of video. So I thought 59-second gourmet, that sounds pretty good. But, you know, I got to tell you, it's really difficult to cook while you're holding a camera at the same time. Because you're only using one hand. Right. I don't know if you've noticed, but it's very like disheveled. It's like, it's not a fantastic production by any means. And then sometimes I look at it and think, geez, you could have put a different shirt on or something, you know?
Well, you've gotten, it seems like it's gotten like even more kind of seamless as like you've done it, because it's been, you know, it's been about a year, right? So, I mean, I kind of got, it feels like you have a little bit of a handle on, you know, like, the transitions between everything. So you're doing a great job, man.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, it's funny, because I was telling my wife that I was going, it's really difficult to do this with one hand. And she goes, well, you know, why don't you ask me? I'll film it. And I went, I never thought about it. But yeah, I might throw a few of them out, a few more out. You know, they're just kind of fun things. But I mean, normally when I'm doing stuff, I'm a lot more meticulous. Right. You know, how I'm cooking and presentation. Here it's just like throwing things in. Okay, I've sort of pre-measured everything because I don't have the time, pardon the pun, but I don't have the time to do all this stuff. So anyway, that's been fun. And I do appear sometimes on a video show, on an internet show on Tuesday mornings called Spill the Tea, which is a show for expats living in Britain. I mean, sorry, expats living in America, British people who are living.
Right.
And so it's very English, and they love those little segments. They actually put them up on the show every week. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's really fun. And like I said, it's cool to see things like that, even, you know, like your cooking show, because it's, you know, having you guys at home now and having many artists at home now, you guys are kind of sharing different things and, you know, kind of, like I said, kind of showing like different sides of you and, you know, what you do when you're at home. You know, you don't spend often too much time at home. So It's fun. It's really cool. So also, you know, right at the beginning of the lockdown, you know, right around this time last year, you had mentioned that you were, you know, briefly beginning to work on an, you know, another solo record, because I know you've had a couple in the past. Mm-hmm. And you released two singles since then. The first in November, that was titled Please Don't Make Me Wait. And the second last month, that was titled Fly Again, which are really cool tracks. They've got some, you know, awesome kind of like funk bits to them, and obviously some really cool notable bass lines, which of course is a given. But I know you've done solo records in the past, like I mentioned. Was this something in the works prior to the pandemic, or, you know, was it the pandemic that really kind of prompted you to want to do your own solo music again?
No, I've always sort of had solo stuff going in the background, and it's a lot of the stuff I write is very commercial. I mean, that's really my style. It works really well sometimes when you have that interpreted by a rock band, for example. It adds a different angle to what you're doing. And but very often it might not be material that fits in with something that I'm doing. So I tend to keep it on a side burner and think, well, you know, at some point I'll put another record together. I was actually having a conversation with my friend Richie Carson, and we were talking about this, and I was saying, you know, I want to put another album together. And he said, you know, I've just kind of been putting singles out, because it's very difficult to make a compelling case to actually make it, you know, create an album, put the album out, manufacture it and sell it and all of that stuff. And really, people just want the, you know, they want to hear the music. And, you know, it's important, I think, to have a video element to the songs, so that way you can incorporate it on, you know, your YouTubes, and you can have something that's visual as well. So I just took his advice and said, oh, you know, I'm going to start finishing these songs one at a time and throwing them out. My studio's behind me. I'm actually working on two more songs at the minute. And so, you know, it's a little challenging, I suppose, because I have to pretty much play everything myself, which is not a problem. I've done that before. My last album, I played everything on it myself. But it'd be nice to work with other people as well. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
So it's a little like sometimes a little one-dimensional when you're working on your own stuff, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, like, because usually, you know, when you're in a band situation, you like bounce ideas off of each other. It's kind of like a brainstorming type of thing. So I could definitely see how that might be a little difficult sometimes, you know, especially for an extended period of time like this, you know.
Yeah, it takes a little bit longer. I mean, most of the stuff I can hear in my head. But there are times when you say, well, let's see how this sounds. So you would record a bass part and then record a guitar part or vice versa, whatever. And then you'd say, okay, well, let me change that and let me re-record that, see how that sounds, and let me adjust something else. And that takes a long time to do. If you're sitting there in a room with someone else, you just try it. But if you're not, you have to actually go through the process of recording it,
right,
listening back, deciding if it works. So it adds time to the process. But as you do that more often, I've often said every artist should try to do a recording where they play everything at some point in their careers, because I think it really is an eye-opener to how all the instruments work together. It really gives you some great arranging skills and production skills as well. So when you do go into a situation, all of a sudden you think, yeah, I know exactly how that's going to sound. I know what I want it to do, and I can hear it here. And you can give direction if that's what's required to be. So it's a really great exercise, you know. It's very cathartic as well. You finish something, you sit back and listen to it and say, you know what, this is pretty good, I like it.
Yeah. And I mean, I know that you've been a songwriter for many years, and I know that, of course, I'm sure you kind of just mentioned you have songs, you kind of put them on the back burner until you want to use them for something. Mm-hmm. But you know, having this time, has it been really refreshing to be able to kind of be so creative just kind of in a songwriting avenue? Because I mean, I know you tour a lot, you play live shows, but it probably hasn't been a while, you know, since you've had the opportunity to kind of sit back, you know, really focus on writing and that skill and that craft. So has it kind of been just a refreshing, you know, time for you that way creatively?
Well, it's very strange, Sydney, because this whole thing has been about, you know, wishing we had time to do some of these projects, but now we have unlimited time. The sort of the impetus has sort of gone. I mean, the drive to do things. Anyone who's creative knows that you sort of get most of your work done in the, you know, 11th hour before a deadline. You know, that's when all of a sudden you have to get something finished. When there's no deadline, it's things kind of meander and drift off, and you're like, yeah, I should get to that at some point. So that's another reason why I've sort of done all these other side projects, because you know, once I finish one of those side projects or while I'm doing it, I'm thinking, oh, you know what, I really should get back and work on that. And it sort of motivates you to want to do some other things. There's a lot to be said for, constant activity being a driving force to doing things rather than sitting around. I'm just not a TV guy. I just don't sit there and watch TV and just, you know, that's just not what I do. I mean, if I want to watch a movie, I'll sit down and watch a movie specifically, you know, but for most times for my own entertainment, I'd rather find something else to do. And if it's not music, just the act of doing that sort of motivates me to want to get back to the music and do something else as well. So maybe that explains why I do all these crazy other things, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, I know that you guys are also in the middle of working on this new Lost and Line record, yeah. Which I believe, because I had Vinny on the podcast not too long ago, so we talked a little bit about, you know, the progress on that, but you guys still have half of the record to finish, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, we've done about half the record, and we in a moment of, I don't know, coincidental chance or whatever it was, we were in LA, and I suggested, why don't we go into a studio that I work at a lot? Why don't we just go cut a couple of tracks? And we thought we'd go cut two tracks, and we all went in there and said, let's see what happens. And by some chance, we ended up cutting like six tracks, and we didn't know. But once the pandemic happened, we had backing tracks that we were able to work on, and that's how we managed to complete half the record. So those songs are done. I mean, they're really good. They're a natural progression, I think, from the two album. So if you take the two album and you sort of draw a line out somewhere into the future, it connects. I mean, you can see where it's evolving from and where it's going to. There's some differences again. That just represents a constant development, a constant evolution of the band. We get to know each other better each time. But the one thing that remains constant is the sort of DNA of the concept of Last in Line, which is also the DNA of the concept of early Dio. You know, just the spirit and the way in which the material is put together. We're using the same method that, you know, Vivian and Vinny and Jimmy Bain, may he rest in peace, was using back then. I'm chomping at the bit for us to get back in the studio and get on with the next six tracks as well. So that would be really fun.
Yeah, because I know that you guys are primarily a band. You don't do, you know, a lot of internet or over, you know, file sharing type stuff. I know you guys tend to, you know, when you work together, you guys get in one room, you record together. So you guys haven't had the opportunity to go ahead and start on the second half yet, right?
Yeah. This last few tracks, we have been doing a little bit of that kind of remote recording and, as you described, file sharing, yeah, type of work for want of a better, a more ideal situation. There's nothing like being in the same room, is it? You know, with everybody and just working on stuff. And some people, you know, we make comments on each other. I mean, you know, I'll make suggestions to Vivi on guitar playing. He'll make suggestions to Vinny. Vinny will make suggestions to me. You know, Andrew will make suggestions. It's we all get involved with each other's parts. I mean, it is a collaborative group effort, and not to have those suggestions and those comments and those ideas coming from the others is a little odd. You know, I know if I put a bass part down, I know I'm going to be proud of it. I know I'm going to think that I did the right, played the right part. But at the end of the day, you want to make sure that you didn't leave any ideas or anyone's ideas off the table. So, you know, if Vinny turns around and says, hey, I think you should change this bass part to fit, that's really valid to me. And it's part of the nice thing about being in a collaborative band arrangement like that. You know?
Yeah.
Kind of miss that part of it. And we're trying to record this other song at the moment. We're doing it purely by remote file sharing, and it's tricky.
is it that cover song that I know that you guys had announced? That can you give us any hints? Or
no, I can't. I have to shoot you. it's a bit of an undertaking, and it's a very well known classic song, very very old. So there you go. But we'll have that done soon. It's with Viv at the moment. He's doing some guitar parts. So as soon as he gets done with that, I think we'll be getting closer.
You know. That's great. And
ask Viv, call Viv up.
I'll get him on the phone right now and be like, I want to know what the cover song is. Come on, hurry up. Finish recording. Yeah, right. Come on. But I mean, I know you joined Last in Line, you know, back in 2016, of course, after the passing of, you know, Jimmy Bain, again, like you said, you know, rest his soul. But I know you joined the band, and it seems to me though that you fit so well alongside, you know, these players. But I mean, I know that you've also developed friendships with them over the years, you know, prior to even joining the band. So for you, you know, was it as natural as it, you know, felt to watch you, you know, join this band and kind of become a part of this group and this project?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Andrew and I had been working on a show for a few years, a show in Vegas here called Raiding the Rockfall, which was a sort of a casino show. So we'd worked together. Vinny and myself had been, we've been in projects since 2005. We've had various different projects that we've worked on, recordings, bands. There's a band called Big Noise that we used to tour around with, like a celebrity band. And then prior to that, you know, obviously we've known each other since Ozzy days. So I always tell everyone that, you know, Ozzy and Dio were very much like sister bands. They sort of were in the same genre. They came from same Black Sabbath, you know, nucleus. And so while we enjoyed success in the 80s, we considered ourselves to be almost parallel bands. So we knew of each other's, we each knew our counterparts, and we had a lot of respect for each other. And so there was, it was very easy for me to do that. Viv was slightly different because although I've known Viv for years, I'd never really worked with them. So this was like a new experience.
Right.
So that part of it was definitely novel.
Yeah, I remember that group that you just mentioned, Big Noise, which had, of course, Vinny on drums. And I remember I just saw, because I was prepping for this, and I saw a video of you guys. You did The Hunter, which is like one of my favorite Dawkins songs. I was prepping for this, and I saw that, and I was like, oh, I forgot all about this group. And I know you guys did some cool stuff in that time a couple years back. Is there anything, you know, I know that was a little bit ago, but did you guys ever think about bringing that back or kind of, you know, doing some shows again?
Yeah, I mean, if the opportunity sort of presents itself, it was, like I said, a celebrity band. We've had all kinds of different people in there. Jolyn Turner was the singer. Sebastian Bach was on one. We had George Lynch come and play guitar. And we just really play three or four songs from each of our repertoires and just do it for fun. The project gets much, much better reception outside of the United States, I'll be honest with you. So we would do a lot of stuff in South America, for example. We do stuff in Europe, Spain, Canary Islands. I mean, all over the place. One of the most remarkable times was when we went to Iraq and Kuwait in 2009. And we entertained troops over there. And that was fantastic. It was just really, really great. It was great to be playing music with my friends. It's great to be playing those songs. And it was great to be playing for these people who just, I mean, I have a whole level of respect for the military, if for nothing else, that one morning they wake up and they've got this piece of paper and it says, that's it, we're gone for 15 months. No questions, no ifs, ands, or buts, and you have to go. And that's it. And, you know, that dedication is, when you think about it, it's pretty tough. I mean, sometimes we think we got it tough being locked up for a year. These people are locked up in some forward operating base for 15 months, not able to see families, not able to see anybody. And so for us to be able to go there in person and spend time with them, you know, we would do a meet and greet afterwards. And it wasn't like, oh, hey, how you doing? Nice to meet you. I mean, we'd literally have a, you know, talk for 5-10 minutes for each person that we met. Sometimes these would go on for 4 or 5 hours because you really wanted to make sure that you had some meaningful interaction. They wanted to talk as well, a lot about stuff. They wanted to, you know, seeing somebody from outside the outside world come in, they wanted to talk about their adventures and what's been going on. And the best you could do is listen. It was overall, it was just a fantastic time, great experience.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting the point you bring up just in general about how that group is much bigger outside of the United States, which just seems to be how it is nowadays, right? Where it's you go out into, you know, again, like the England, the, you know, Germany, the South America, you know, all these different places, and rock is still huge, which is a point I bring up all the time. I'm like, why is it not like this here? But that's just a fascinating point, you know, that even, you know, a decade ago at this point, it was kind of on that way to kind of being the way the industry is now, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. It was, you know, there was a time I remember in the 80s probably where, you know, America was the big market and Europe and everything else was added as an afterthought.
Right.
And now, I mean, you know, Europe is a huge thing. And I actually remember a turning point. I remember having a conversation with John Bon Jovi, and he said, you know, we used to sell, I forget how many it was, millions of albums in America, and so many, you know, now we sell 6 million albums in Europe and 600,000 in America. And it was a turning point. And I think it was right around, it was probably right around 93, 94. I remember him saying that. And from that point, it's never really, I mean, the biggest festivals, rock festivals, are all in Europe now. They're enormous. We get to play some of them sometimes. And I mean, you just think, where do these people come from? My dogs come to say hello.
I mean, I did, it was funny. I did my senior thesis this past fall. I got my degree in music business, and I did my senior thesis. And the part of my senior thesis was all about the fact that, a lot of, you know, rock music is not as big here in the US anymore. I mean, you look at, you just mentioned those festivals like Sweden Rock and Wacken.
Yeah.
And I mean, hundred thousand people flock out to these festivals, and rain or shine, you know, they're in the mud and they're, you know, headbanging and rocking out. And
yeah, it's more often rain than shine, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's more rain than shine, right? And I mean, I always bring up the kind of the age old example of, you know, watching those concert videos of like Iron Maiden in Brazil or like in Rio. And it's, you know, just like a completely different world than it is here. And you know, I've been, you know, racking my brain, you know, I try to figure it out, and I, you know, I have nothing else other than the fact that I feel like, and I've had some other people say this as well, that we're a little bit more trend focused here. You know, we kind of are all about what's in and what's not in, and you know, what's popular. But
I don't know if it's that or if it's just, you know, that I've always seen metal and rock as being styles of music that are always present, but then sometimes they sort of go underground a little bit.
Right.
Sometimes they come up on top. And there were times, of course, during the 80s where that was the predominant, most popular music was rock here. And now it's sort of, you know, I mean, it's its own world. I mean, you can go to an AC/DC show, or you can go to a, you know, to a any kind of really cool one of many different metal shows, and they'll be packed full of people. And yet that's not reflected in any kind of chart successes or current chart awareness or what have you. So that to me says that's like an underground movement, you know, it's there, it's very much present, and but it doesn't have any bearing on chart presence.
And I mean, I always look to, you know, because I want to talk a little bit about also your time in Aussie, but like I always bring up the thing about, you know, they always play like, you know, Crazy Train at like football games and, you know, baseball games. It's always, you know, it's always there. It's always present, you know, maybe not, like you said, like on the charts or anything like that too much anymore, but it is always there. And I want to talk about your time in Aussie because, you know, that album specifically to me, again, kind of the little bit of the music fan, the major music fan that is, of course, inside me. It was a very special album to me, The Ultimate Sin, that you were a part of. And quick kind of funny story is, you know, I kind of grew up with this music, and my parents are huge fans. I'm only 21, so I kind of grew up, you know, listening to this music and having, you know, rock and metal, you know, be the soundtrack to my childhood. But when I was, I gotta say, probably 4 or 5 years old, my parents would tell me that whenever I would hear Shot in the Dark, I would lose my mind. And over the years, it's, you know, just one of those things from my childhood that I, you know, it's still, you know, my favorite Aussie song. You know, it was a huge hit, I know, but it's was very special to me, and that album is as a whole. So of course, I just wanted to thank you for writing that song, or helping to write that song, because it has played a very integral role in my life as a music fan. So
Well, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much. You know, one of the most amazing things about doing something like that is I think the first time that we performed it live, you know, I'd written these lyrics and I'd worked hard on writing those lyrics, and then all of a sudden just watching people not only knowing the lyrics but singing the lyrics was just blew me away. I remember thinking to myself, how do they know the lyrics? And it's amazing how quickly, you know, people become very aware about every aspect of a song once they hear it, once they attach themselves to it, once they identify with it. So that was quite a moment. It was a moment, yeah, for me as well as for everybody else. So it was a great time. Playing with Ozzy was undoubtedly one of the, I'm very grateful to Ozzy for the opportunity that I had with him and the time that I spent with him. And it was an eye opener. And, he's, of course, he's a natural at what he does, and he's completely unique. There is no other Ozzy. So it was, at the time, it was very well received. We were the biggest band in America. So
right.
It was quite an experience.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, like you mentioned, just talking about, you know, hearing people sing those lyrics back to you when that song first came out, you know, you kind of look as the years have progressed, and I mean, that song is still a staple in Ozzy's set list, you know, to this day, up until, you know, the last time I saw him back in 2018, he still plays that song, it still gets played constantly, it's, you know, one of those songs that, you know, almost everybody knows when it comes to Ozzy's catalog, so... I mean, for you, is it kind of just crazy and fulfilling or validating to you to kind of just see the legacy that has been created with that album and that song? Because, you know, it's been, we just celebrated the 35th anniversary as well. I just remembered that, you know, a couple weeks ago, and, you know, that song is still super relevant in Ozzy's catalog.
Yeah, I guess it's, sometimes he plays it, sometimes sometimes he doesn't, but it does get continually played and continuously played. And I do, you know, I hear it on the radio sometimes, and it's kind of funny. It comes on, I go, wow, still on the radio. So that's cool. But you know, the whole songwriting process, you can't gauge it by the success of one song or not. I mean, that's not why we write songs. And very often we write, I mean, I've written a lot of songs that have not had anywhere near the same kind of public broadcast, but I think are extremely valid as well. The songs I'm very proud of, and you know, you have to, you know, my gauge now, I mean, it was a great thing to happen. I mean, you can't expect that's gonna happen every time. It's a wonderful thing when it does. But when you go back to writing songs, the idea for me is when I've written a song and I sit back and I listen to it, and I feel like it's really helped me understand what it is that inspired me to write the song in the first place. If it's an experience, if it's a good experience, if it's a bad experience, if it's a life event, if it's something I just don't understand and I'm trying to put it into words, it's almost like a therapeutic thing. So I'm trying to write the song and I'm trying to understand what I feel. And you know when it's right. You know when you listen to the song and you say, you know, this really sums up how I feel about this. And you get some kind of closure on it. My wife's a therapist, and she said to me one day, she goes, "You ever consider going for therapy?" And I went, "Why would I want to do that? I just need to talk out all the ideas I have for writing songs. You know, I wouldn't have anything to write songs about anymore." So there's a therapeutic side to it.
Yeah, and I think I can even see that, you know, especially with the songs, the singles that you just released, you know, in these last couple of months. And you know, the great thing about that and about music as a whole is that, you know, listeners can take away different meanings and different, you know, just subject matter from these songs. And, you know, for me, when I listened to these, I felt that they, you know, because I know that the first single released back in November was kind of targeted towards, you know, the shutdown of the live music industry and everything like that. But I feel like both of them in general just kind of could really be related to the kind of, you know, unique experience that we've all dealt with over the last, you know, year. And, you know, I know that that's, you know, when you wrote these songs or recorded them. So I think that, you know, sometimes that subject matter, you know, translate and also can, you know, be picked up by listeners in different ways, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Please Don't Make Me Wait was funny because, you know, I'd had that idea and that title for a while. And it was a title that was waiting for something to write about. Makes sense. But I had the title and I liked the idea of having to wait for something. And there were a couple of different ideas that I was going to hang on to that. And then I remember sitting down there one day and I was thinking, you know what? I'm living it. This is it. This is what we're living. Everyone's living like, you know, don't let us wait to get on with our lives. You know, we want to get on with our lives here, and please don't make me wait. And the song wrote itself. I just wrote exactly how I felt. And it became, some people at radio stations over here consider it to be a bit of an anthem to the lockdown, to not to the lockdown, but to the lack of live entertainment, the lack of live music, live venues. They identified with it. And, you know, that was one of those songs that just kind of wrote itself to me. You know, Fly is a different song. Fly is something I've been working on for a long time. And it was just, you know, about, you know, helping somebody with their own life, you know, trying to be there as a friend for someone. So I think that was something I wanted to, you know, put across as well. You know, you definitely have to sit down there and think about what the inspiration is. And then the hardest part about writing a song, I tell people when writing songs, is you write a song about an idea, about something you feel, and then you put it down. And then the hardest part is to try to extract yourself out of it. Because the last thing you want to do is give somebody a song that says, you know, I fell in love with this girl and she left and broke my heart. Everyone's like, well, you know, yeah, that sucks, whatever. They don't really identify with it. But if you can take yourself out of it and put the rest of it there, then other people will identify and say, well, you know what, that happened to me. That's my story. It's exactly what happened. And once they identify with it, then I think you've made a connection.
Yeah.
That's how I look at songwriting.
Yeah. I mean, like, personally for me as a music fan, I'm a huge lyric person. And that's how I often relate to, you know, different songs. And I mean, not every, you know, song's lyrics, you know, grab me in a personal way, but those that do, you know, yeah, they're like just vague enough, just specific enough, you know, just, you know, that enough of what can make a song relatable. And so I felt that way. I'm sure you have as well, you know, not just being a songwriter, but a music listener, you know, to many songs over the years. And I think you're completely right. It's just so interesting to see how people can take the words you've written, you know, that you wrote about a specific experience, you know, that you were going through or you were dealing with, and, you know, they can kind of make it their own.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it's just a changing of a word, you know, you know, I just used an example of, you know, you fell in love with some girl and then she left you and broke your heart. You know, if I say that, it's very polarized. It's just one way. But if I turn it into a question, have you ever fallen in love with somebody you left you and broke your heart? Now, all of a sudden, it's about you. It's not about me.
Right.
It's about someone else. And so just changing that juxtaposition a little bit is all it might take. But there's songs, there's some lyrics which I've written I'm very proud of. You know, there was a song called Broken Machine that I wrote for Steve Lukather. It's one of my favorite lyrics that I've written. And it really was something that took a long time to write because I was trying to hone in on what exactly I was feeling about this particular situation. And so, and when you've done it and you've managed to take yourself out of it, so many people came up to me and said, hey, you know, when we were working on that record, Steve was good friends with the late, Eddie Van Halen, you know. So Eddie was in the studio with us when we were mixing that album, and he pulled me aside on more than one occasion. Said, yeah, that song's me. That song is me. And I thought, well, that's great that you can identify with it. And then I ran to Alex, and he came up to me and goes, hey, let me tell you something. That song's me. I have. and Luke said to me the same thing. And all these people would come up and say, I really identify with that song. And that made me feel great because it not only it made me feel that, you know, I wasn't the only person who had this kind of experience or whatever it was. And I'd written something that a lot of people could relate to.
Right.
And ultimately, when you listen to music, when I listen to music, there's times when music makes me feel better about something. It makes me feel happy, makes me feel, you know, sometimes makes me feel sad, but sometimes makes me feel better about something that I'm going through. And so just that identifying with someone else is a great thing. And that's really art, isn't it? I mean, you know, I've got friends who paint. I can't paint for shit, but, you know, they paint. And, you know, Randy Castillo was a great painter. I was painting in my studio, but he would say the same thing. He'd say he put his emotion into these paintings when people would see the paintings, they'd feel the same emotion that he had when he was doing the painting.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess that's art.
Yeah.
And like kind of communication, right?
Right. I mean, but it's kind of all, you know, cut from the same cloth, you know. It's, you know, it's, you're just describing, you know, music, especially in, you know, lyrics, you know, it's one of those things. If I hear a song that I relate to and it's something that, whether it's about a happy subject matter or a sad subject matter, you know, like you said, being able to identify, and it's almost like this sounds so cliche, but like to hear something, you know, like somebody else is going through that. I'm not the only one that's gone through X, Y, Z, or has had X, Y, Z feelings, happy, sad, angry, whatever. It can be, you know, yeah, kind of just relieving or, you know, refreshing to know that somebody out there, you know, whether it's a, you know, multi-million dollar songwriter, or, you know, just a song that your friend wrote or something, you know, that somebody out there can feel, you know, the same way that you're feeling. So it's,
yeah, nice. We all have the same things. It doesn't matter what you sell, what you, who you are. We still have frustrations. We still have anger. We still have sadness, still have all of these things. And this is what we write about. So we write about these things, you know, and doesn't take anything away from being slapstick either. I mean, you know, if you want to write a song that says the do 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 the da da da, I mean, that's fine too. You know, there's nothing wrong with that as well. There's stuff that's just fun.
Yeah.
You know? So I think you have to have a little bit of all of these things together. And as a songwriter, you don't, you know, you don't have, I don't have one sentiment. I'm not like an angry person or a happy person. It's just a big bag of, you know, it depends on what side of bed I got out this morning, you know.
Right. So you mentioned that you're working on two new songs right now, and you are taking kind of, as you mentioned, the approach of kind of releasing a single at a time. So do you know when we might hear some of these? I know you're still working on them, so maybe somewhat in the near future?
Yeah, I've got one track that I'm, a song called "The Nobody's Fool," and it's a really tough drum part. I've been trying to play the drums on it, just not that good. So I've decided to program it, and the program is sounding much, much better. So I'm going to do that this afternoon and finish that off. And, you know, I want to create a little video for it as well. So that usually adds a lot of time to the process. Oh, a couple of weeks, maybe.
Yeah.
The other song is, it's a great, a really, really cool, exciting track. And it's a little bit more, you know, my sort of funk background, but a little bit more, I don't know, blue-eyed soul kind of thing, you know. And but that needs to really be written. It's not quite finished yet. And then there's a whole bunch of other, you know, I've got a drive and it's got all of these things, and they're all called things like idea number one, idea number two, you know. They just have like very creative titles, and you just kind of work through them, and it's nice. You go away from something and get away from it for a few months, then you pick it up and listen to it too. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, you get inspired to want to finish it. So sometimes if I'm working on a song and I've taken it to this point and I don't seem to be able to take it any further, I'll just put it away and come back to it.
Yeah. So you're kind of releasing them as singles. Is there any plan to eventually have it add up to an album, or are you kind of just, yeah?
No. Yeah, I'd like to put them on it. Maybe I can get it to where I have an extra three songs or something, or three or four songs, and actually create another record. You know, I was really proud of when I did my solo records because I made them look really good, and they were like kind of almost collectible. They you know, six-panel gate, digipack gatefolds, and, you know, lyric book inside and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, I still have that thing from when I was a kid, and we used to go and get albums and read the album covers and carry album covers around. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. We'd go to school and you'd have an album cover under, or a bunch of albums under you. You just walk around with these albums. It was the most stupid thing, because where are you going? You know, you're not going to play them anyway. You just take them to school and take them home again afterwards. But it was almost like a badge. It told people who you were, what you were into, what kind of music you liked. And then, you know, people would identify with each other based upon liking the same styles of music or the same types. Somebody would occasionally have an album that was really obscure. So you've got like an Alice Cooper poster behind you, but when the School's Out album came, that was just like, wow, look at this thing. It looks like a desk.
Right.
You know? How cool is that? And I remember that. But that's something that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, what do you walk around with now? You know, like a, you know what the capacity is of my phone? You know, it's like,
yeah,
you don't really get to see what people like, you know?
It's crazy. I had a conversation today with somebody about that. And, you know, we were talking about vinyl. And I mean, I started collecting vinyl, you know, a couple years ago because, you know, it was me going through my parents' old records. And I mean, I grew up in a digital age, unfortunately. So, you know, when I saw vinyl records for the first time, and I feel like, you know, that's one of the only good things about my generation bringing a lot of, you know, like vinyl back and things like that, is I think that, you know, being exposed to that and yeah, being able to open it up and see a gatefold and like see, you know, first thing I thought of was like the Love Gun and Kiss's Love Gun. And, you know, like, you know, things like that, that made the record, an experience. You know, you put the record on and it was more than just, you know, putting it on and forgetting about it or streaming it. It was, I have to put it on the turntable and I have to put the needle on and I have to, you know, I'm looking at the big imagery and the artwork and all this cool stuff. And, you know, it's not the same when you're looking at it kind of, you know, like you just mentioned, it's a little square picture on a phone, you know, it's not the same.
Yeah. And, you know, the whole idea of flipping between tracks and moving on to this one, we just didn't do that. You put the record on and you, like you said, you put the needle on and you listen to half the side of an album and you would listen to it. And you would read the, you know, the album cover, or you'd do something else, whatever. But, you know, when it came to the end of that, you'd have to turn it over or put another record on. But you didn't just go, oh, no, okay, let me do the next track, or let me go back a little bit. It was a process. It was like, yeah, it was like a show. It's like a TV show. But, you know, you went through these songs. And some of my favorite albums almost, you know, they almost played like mini movies. If you listen to a Queen album, I mean, right?
Right.
You've got all these different sounding tracks and it's just, it's like a musical, but without the picture, you know?
Yeah. And you're like we kind of go back to, you know, now this, the way the industry has evolved and yeah, you know, kind of now it's releasing singles. And, you know, I think that part of that, you know, being able to flip between tracks and not have to listen to a whole album is kind of has what, you know, has made that evolve. You know, it's, you used to have to listen to the whole record. You used to have to buy the whole record. You'd have to wait in line and, you know, buy or go into a record store and buy the record without even knowing what it sounded like. And you'd have to come home and put it on, you know, and it's, you know, not like that anymore, but I have my fingers crossed, you know, their vinyl's kind of coming back and I hope it's not just a fad, as some people say. I hope it's, you know, something that kind of carries over the next couple of years, because I think
it's not a fad. It's not a fad. And I think what it is it's an alternative way to enjoy music as well, because it is a different type of experience. It's, as you described it, it's a different listening experience and it's a different acquisition experience too. And it's funny, you would say that you buy an album, you wouldn't hear it, but I'm gonna date myself here, but back in the day it was you know, record stores had listening booths.
Yeah.
You could take the album to the front and say, I want to hear this. And they'd put it on, you'd go listen to it in headphones. And you'd spend hours. Or I was a kid again. You know, he wants to hear every album in the store. And I would listen to all of these records. And then eventually, you know, I'd pick the one or two that I was going to buy and come back again in another week and do the same thing all over again. I spent hours in record stores. Hours. I mean, just going through all the album covers, reading everything. It was, you know, it was so cool. And it was just an experience which a lot of people don't experience or haven't experienced. It would be great if people discover that for themselves. Yeah. There are record stores in every town, in every city in the world. And you can go and find that obscure record store and at least experience that and see if it's something that adds, that brings something to you, you know?
Yeah.
So that's my hope. That sometimes I talk to people who are unawares of this. I said, just go and do that. Go into a record store, wander around, and, you know, for a couple of hours and see what you find. It's kind of cool.
And I mean, nowadays, especially for me, I'm a collector and, you know, I go to record stores all the time. And I mean, I go to both, you know, collect records that I want and also, you know, buy new records or whatever. But, you know, for me, there's no better feeling when I'm like looking for a record and, you know, you're searching through all the stores and you finally find it.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny because I talk to people and they're like, I just buy it online. But I'm like, you're missing it. Like you're missing the hunt, you know, like you can go and like search for it. And then when you find it, it's that like magical feeling of I found it, you know, like I, you know, it's in- it's a whole experience. It's, to me, it's almost like a whole kind of like culture that kind of exists in these like little, you know, stores, you know, and small towns or cities, you know, it's a whole thing. It's cool.
Yeah. No, you nailed it. You nailed it. You find that record. It's like, got it. You know, but, and then you take care of them as well. You really do.
Yeah.
You know, you have your records, and I'd be like meticulous about the covers, make sure they were all in plastic and
yeah. It's, this was my dad's. I have my ultimate.
Wow.
And this was one of the records which he kept it in very good condition. I mean, normally have it in plastic, but yeah, like this is one I was very lucky. I didn't have to find it because my dad just gave it to me. So
that's awesome. It looks in great condition.
Yeah, he kept it in pretty good shape, but you know, stuff like that where it's, you know, that's also another thing is if you find them and they're in really great condition, it's like, yes.
Right.
Such a great feeling. Well, before I let you go, at the end of every single one of my interviews, I kind of ask the same five questions. They're called the Metal from the Inside Five, and they're kind of just questions that are kind of a little bit more vague just to get my audience to know my guests just a little bit better. So the first question is, if you weren't working in the profession that you're currently in, so obviously bass player, songwriter, musician, what do you think that you would be doing?
Chef,
yes.
Probably chef, maybe photographer, you know, two things I really became very passionate about.
But, yeah.
They're both, well, chef being a chef, actually, I owned a restaurant in Los Angeles, a Japanese sushi restaurant that was a very kind of high-end traditional Japanese restaurant. So we didn't have like a lot of rolls or anything. It was just traditional sushi. And it's very much like music. You're entertaining. When you own a restaurant, that's what you're doing. You're entertaining people. There's nothing, trust me, there's almost nothing better than owning a restaurant and watching people come in, sit down and have a great evening, have a great time, have a great experience with their friends and going over and meeting them and, you know, buying them a drink or whatever, or giving them stuff on the house and watching them come back again because they had such a great time. It's really kind of like entertaining as well. So for that reason, I think that's really what draws me to that.
Yeah. Would you ever think about trying to own another restaurant or something like that?
Not right now. No, when the restaurant got sold, I had partners and the restaurant had to get sold because my partners were not really motivated to want to stay in that business. And
right.
I didn't have a choice and I was really bummed. But it got sold. And then it wasn't just a couple of years later that I'm looking back going, well, you know, that was probably a blessing in disguise because I don't know how I'd have managed to keep it going through all of this.
Right, right. I mean, now you have 59 second gourmet and COVID-19 kitchen. So I think that you're doing just fine.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can now do more than 59 seconds as well, which is a dampener on my whole concept. But, you know.
Gonna have to change the name to like, you know, however, I don't even know how long.
5 minute gourmet.
Yeah, 5 minute gourmet, right. Reminds me of like that Rachel Ray's like 30 minute meals, like way back on the day, like the Food Network. It's funny.
Oh, right. Yeah. I used to love the Food Network.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to sit there and watch that over other TV shows. And a lot of musicians, you know, we were closet Food Channel watchers. I remember that Slash was as well. I was talking to Slash about it. We were talking about it one night. And he said he confessed to me. He goes, yeah, I like Food Channel.
I love that that's like a confession. Like it's something that like, the rock guys are like scared to say that I go back to my hotel room and I watch the Food Network. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Back in the day, there was a little group of us that would meet every Tuesday night at a Mexican restaurant around in LA and we would just get together. And one day I was talking to him and he told me, I watch the Food Network. It's like Foodies Anonymous or something, right? What do you call that? FA.
Yeah, it's almost like if I admit that I watch the Food Network, it makes me a little less metal. Like right. they can't know that I watch the Food Network.
Exactly. Guys are entertaining too. Some of these chefs, I don't need to tell you. They're entertainers. Absolutely.
And I mean, you know, it's like, it's funny because a lot of these like chefs too, who have these shows on Food Network, they become like personalities themselves. You know what
sure.
I mean? They have, you know, like first one I thought of like Gordon Ramsay, you know, he's his own, like he's his own personality. Like you said, his own like entertainer, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So the second question I have for you is what is something that you wish everybody knew about you? So I always kind of say like, is it something that's kind of a secret talent? Is there like a guilty pleasure music that you listen to? Like something like that?
I don't know. I think it would have to be, you know, I was on the I was on the road to being a doctor. I was going to pre-med, so I have like all my advanced education in sciences, physics and chemistry, and biology and mathematics, and so I'm into a lot of that stuff. The two subjects that I kind of loved very much but failed at, well, actually, the one subject I loved very much and failed at was English literature. And it's really ironic because I love Dickens and I love Shakespeare and I loved all of that stuff. And it's what I've chosen to make my living at. And so I was sort of scratching my head and thinking, well, I would really like my teachers back then to know that I've made a really sick success out of what they failed me at. If that answers your question.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm like the complete opposite. I if you put a math problem in front of me, man, somebody else has to solve it. I have no idea. It's really funny. I feel like I've talked to different people and like friends and things. It's either you're really good at like math and science and you weren't too great at English, or you were really good at English and you weren't too great at math and science, like in school.
You know, there's always been a correlation, I think, between math and between music. And some people have tried to identify that as being that that music is somewhat mathematical in certain aspects. And I have a tendency to agree with that, although it's not that obvious. It's definitely a little bit obscure. Math was something that was just, we have a different education system in England. We have what's called advanced level exams, degrees, whatever you want to call them. And so I have all of these advanced level degrees in all of these sciences, but music was up there as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if they're connected or correlated.
Theory is a little bit, you know, when I took music theory as well. I mean, if you're really kind of getting into like the theory aspect of music, you know, sometimes that can be a little, you know, kind of similar to, you know, mathematics when it comes to like the way the, you know, the brain works and kind of processes it, you know.
Well, the brain identifies like notes based upon their frequency, and there are correlations and patterns. And if you double the frequency, you have an octave. And if you triple, you know, so you have this, which is inherently mathematical.
Yeah.
But you interpret that as some kind of an identification. What makes you hear one note and hear a note an octave above and think that they sound the same? What does that? I don't know. I don't know that it really sounds the same. I think it's your brain says, well, these can be both divisible. The higher frequency can be divisible by two and give you the lower frequency. And so therefore we relate to it as being, it must be the same note.
Right.
And in that respect, I suppose you could make that case, but it's interesting, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a cool fact. I didn't know that. Yeah. The third question is the age old question. If you were stranded on a desert island and you only had 3 records you can bring with you to listen to, what would they be off the top of your head?
Have to be, there's a Zeppelin album in there. I'm not sure which. If I had to pick one, I would probably say Physical Graffiti. A second album would have to be Hunky Dory by David Bowie.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. That's an album that made me, that just opened my whole mind to what it was I wanted to do. And the third album would have to be, I'm just trying to think of something that I keep listening to all the time. Oh, it's got to be a Steely Dan album. Anyone, Asia probably, you know. I mean, I would, it's just toss up between that and the Sun Sessions Elvis Presley recordings. So, you know, there are too many records that I like.
Oh,
I mean,
there's so many. It's so hard to pick. I'm really shocked though to hear Hunky Dory. I haven't heard anybody say that. That's one of my favorite albums of all time as well. It's,
yeah,
so good. I mean, I know it's kind of cliche, but I mean, you know, Life on Mars is one of my favorite songs of all time. It's just perfection.
There's a really great story about that. I don't know if you care to hear it, but you know, Bowie was a pretty much folk songwriter. That's what he was, and he created such a unique style of music by attaching himself to people who were very, very unlikely in terms of musicians, whether it was Mike Garson, who played piano, who's a jazz guy, whether it was Robert Fripp, whether it was Mick Ronson, whether it was whoever else. And he always did this and managed to create something very unique. But he was at heart a folk writer, and he was approached, I think it was Warner Chappell's, his publishing company approached him, and they said, there's a guy called Claude Francois, who's a huge, huge French artist. He was like, he'd be like the French Frank Sinatra or something, right? And he had a huge hit with a song called Comme d'habitude. And you'd recognize it, of course. But he said, we want you to write English lyrics to this French song so that we can have an English hit with it. And he started writing the lyrics, and he wrote this thing. And at the 11th hour, they turned around and said, ah, sorry, we've given it to somebody else. We I don't know, for whatever reason that happens in the music business. Well, we maybe owe a favor to someone. They gave it to Paul Anka. And Paul Anka wrote the lyrics, and the song became My Way.
Yes. Right? Okay. Yes, I have heard that story before, way back when.
So Bowie, not being a man who wanted a good idea to go to waste, said, well, screw him. I'm just going to take the lyrics I wrote or the and write it around the melody of that same song and rewrite that same song. Yeah. And he wrote Life on Mars. So when you listen to Life on Mars, it sounds very similar to My Way.
Yeah.
And that was the inspiration of for doing that. It's a great song.
So incredible. Just that entire album, you know, David Bowie, this was one of my most influential, you know, just musicians and people. And yeah, it's
absolutely
incredible, incredible record. Yeah. The fourth question I have for you is, what is one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self?
To my younger self, I'd probably say, that's a really tough one. I'd probably try to sort of educate myself more on how to become successful in the world, but not through one particular aspect of music or whatever. I mean, how to survive in the world. That, you know, I see so many people around me who are brilliant artists and what have you, and struggling. They really, really struggle hard. And I learned something which they don't teach you at school, which is home economics, which is how to save, how to set yourself up, how to set your life up, how not to do stupid things. Nobody teaches you that stuff. And I've been smart enough to learn it, and I try to help my friends as well. I help them with setting up savings accounts and with investment advice and all of that stuff. And I think I inherited that from a gentleman who was very dear to me. He was my godfather, actually, and he always taught me some common sensibilities. If it's advice for myself, I would probably have started to do that earlier, but I certainly love to share that advice with anybody I see. I mean, if I see young musicians, I always tell them, hey, you know, always, yeah. What's that great saying? Spend what you've got left after saving, not the other way around.
Yeah.
Don't save what you've got left after spending. You know, yeah. Take care of yourself, you know, build yourself a savings, build your retirement, build, work towards that. Then one day you don't have to be successful, but you have your home, you have yourself set up, and you can sit there and write songs on your own.
Yeah.
You know, on your own dime.
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have parents who taught me, you know, from a very early age when I would start getting allowance, you know, like to say, yeah, you know, saving things and, you know, budgeting stuff aside if I, you know, wanted to buy an ice cream at school or, you know, something, you know, and even in simple stuff like that, you know, it eventually kind of, you know, bigger things. I have student loans now and stuff like that, and, you know, kind of managing that type of thing. So I completely agree with that. It's an important skill set to have.
Yeah. And like I said, nobody teaches you that at school. They should teach you that at school. They should say, okay, now we've got the home economics class, whatever it is. Like you said, budgeting. You know, if you get X amount, who you work or whatever, you've got to budget this. You've got to learn how to take care of your house, your you know, your business, the personal business. If there was anything, I don't think there's anything else. I would, you know, I'm quite happy with everything that I did and the way that I did it. Not trying to sound full of myself or anything of the sort. I think that, you know, if there's one bit of advice, it's don't take everything. Yeah, you know, I take things very seriously as well. Sometimes you need to kind of relax a little bit, not take things too seriously.
Yeah.
I get very worked up about things and get frustrated with things. And it's like, hey, it's okay. It's not the end of the world. The outcome is not important. The journey is what's important.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, I mean, you know, kind of everything happens for a reason. And, you know, if you went back and changed anything in your life, you know, you'd have a completely different, you know, experience.
Sometimes it's very difficult to see that reason, you know. So there was a 1994, there was a terrible earthquake in Los Angeles, and I lost my condo in the earthquake. And at that time, it just seemed like the biggest disaster in the world. And things were not really good at that time. But as a result of the earthquake, people started going out and rebuilding and hiring jobs, and the economy started to improve. And all of a sudden, business started to get better. And actually, it turned out to be a really good thing. All lots of unrelated things kind of came together, and something positive came out of it at the end. So I say to people, sometimes if something happens, and you just have to have faith and go, you might not see why this is happening right now, but in retrospect, this might turn out to be a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
So you have to be open to that possibility.
Absolutely. I try to go through a life of, you know, maybe not everything happens the way that I want it to happen, but it's happening. Everything's kind of happening for my greater good, if that makes sense, you know, like no matter how it happens, it's happening for one day, for it's going to have a reason. It's going to have a purpose. So I completely agree with that. The last question I have for you is kind of a fun question. If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
One superpower. Psychic abilities to make things move around. One of my other hobbies is motorcycles, and I've decided to rebuild a bike. So I was working yesterday on it, and I was just taking something off, and all of a sudden I realized I hadn't undone something, and I was holding this gas tank, and I'm going, yeah, there's a screwdriver right there, and I need to get the screwdriver, and I can't let this thing go. And you know, it would be great just to turn around and go, screwdriver, and just comes right here.
Right.
That would be cool, right?
Yeah, that would be, that's a good one. That's one that would come in handy many times. Or, you're lazy, you're sitting on the couch, you're laying in bed, there's something across the room, you know, super easy.
just yell, remote. Boom.
Well, Phil, this has been so great. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your morning to come on the podcast. Like I said, you know, your music has meant a great deal to me over the years, and I was very happy to have you on. So thank you.
I'm very thrilled to hear that. Thank you very much for having me on. It was a real pleasure speaking with you as well, Sydney, and to all of your people and people tuning in. So it was really great. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah. And everybody, be sure to, of course, stay updated with Last in Line. They're on Facebook, Instagram, all that good stuff. We'll be putting it in the description so you can keep up with Phil and everything the band's doing. As I mentioned, they are doing live streams every once in a while over on their Facebook page. So if you want to stay up to date with the guys, that's how you do so. And of course, stay up to date with everything that Phil is doing. His new single's coming out hopefully soon. His past singles that were released and everything like that. So
yeah, give him a listen. For fun.
You guys just finished listening to my interview with bass player for Last in Line and solo artist Phil Suzon. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to our conversation as much as I enjoyed being a part of it. I love interviews like that, the one you just listened to, because it's so much fun when the interviews just kind of turn into a conversation, you know, when they have a lot of time to talk, these artists. And, you know, of course you want to hit a lot of different points, but sometimes the conversation just goes into a completely different place, which is so unexpected but so fun. And I feel like that's what today's interview is like. So I really, really loved this conversation. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to it as well. If you guys really loved what you heard and are interested in donating to the Metal from the Inside podcast, you guys can go to www.anchor.fm/metalfromtheinside. Here you can click on the support button and donate either $1, $5, or $10 a month directly to the podcast. As always, every single dollar that I receive will go directly back into creating and producing more episodes and content for you guys. A donation is by no means necessary, though, for you guys to listen to the podcast. The podcast is available for 100% free on every streaming service, including Spotify, Apple, Amazon, iHeartRadio, CastBox, Anchor, Google Podcasts, pretty much anywhere that you get your podcasts. And we are also, again, on YouTube. Just go ahead and type in Metal from the Inside on the YouTube search bar. Our channel should come right up. Click the subscribe button happen. If you don't want to miss any interviews, just like the one you're listening to here, we have all of our visual components to every single interview on the YouTube channel. So if you'd like to go ahead and watch my interview with Phil Suzan, that is where you can do so. So be sure to go ahead and subscribe to the Metal from the Inside YouTube channel. If you'd like to stay up to date with Metal from the Inside and get direct links to podcast episodes, get new rock news, and all of that fun stuff, the best place to do so is at www.metalfromtheinside.com. We are also on Instagram at Metal from the Inside, on Twitter at MFTI Official, and you can also go ahead and like our official Facebook page. If you'd like to stay up to date with me, Sydney Taylor, in real time, I am on Instagram at Sydney Anna Taylor and on Twitter at S Taylor Official. If you'd also like to reach me, you can go ahead and click the contact tab on Metal from the Inside's website. Every single message sent through that contact form will go directly to me. I always love to chat hard rock and metal with you guys, so that is the best place to do so. You can also feel free to send me a message on Instagram and Twitter, or leave a comment on one of our YouTube videos. I will always get back to everybody. Sometimes it does take me a little bit of time, but if you have not heard from me yet, don't worry. I will get back to everybody as soon as possible. So if you want to chat hard rock and heavy metal, that is the best place to do it. A big thanks again to all of you for taking the time to listen to the Metal from the Inside podcast. All of your support does not go unnoticed, and I'm so thankful to have such a wonderful community here of just hard rock and heavy metal fans who love to talk about this music and support this music as much as I do. So I'm so thankful for every single one of you. There are some incredible interviews that are in the works, that are scheduled and coming up for you guys to listen to very, very soon. So be sure to stay tuned. Check back every single Friday for a brand new episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast. Share the podcast with all of your metalhead friends, and we will be right back here for another episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast before you guys know it. I'm Sydney Taylor. See you soon, and rock on.